But I wanted to take a look at, starting today and kind of like hopscotching a little bit through the parts of the summer, is some midrashim that really are both seasonally and parsha-wise appropriate. These are Midrashei Eicha Rabba. I want to give a quick introduction to Eicha Rabba and then talk about what the particular piece that we're going to look at and talk about what it is we're doing when we're trying to study Midrash. First of all, Midrash, larger picture. The word Lidrosh means to seek. When you're engaged in Midrash, you're seeking more meaning from a verse than is readily there. There's Midrash Halacha, which we're all familiar with. We engage with a lot in the Gemara. Of trying to decipher what the intent of the text is halachically, or what we can derive from it. And the rules for Midrash Halacha are very rigorous, and at the end of a debate or a dispute, there's going to be either concession or separate camps. There's going to be no big tent. When it comes to Midrash Agadah, which is the one we commonly think of as Midrash, is a very big tent. The rules are quite loose as far as how to create a Midrash and structure a Midrash. And like I said, big tent in that you could have divergent interpretations of a verse and they all kind of live together and they can all be kind of meaningful. Midrashei Agadah that we have are chiefly on 10 different books. The five books of Chumash and the five Megillot, because these are what's read publicly, because the Midrashim were presented publicly. And the most popular collection of Midrash, because Midrashim weren't written in a book. They were floating out there, repeated and canonized, sort of like as part of the national consensus of this is how we look at things. And then they got collected into various collections. The most famous collection is Midrash Rabbah. But to call it a collection is a little bit misleading, because Midrash Rabbah includes books that were composed in the 4th century all the way to the 9th century. So at some point, they all kind of fell into place, but it was not like a deliberate attempt to create a collection. And two of the earliest collections that we have of Midrash are Bereshit Rabbah and Eicha Rabbah. And Eicha Rabbah has a particular poignancy because in what the Chachamim do in Eicha Rabbah is they speak about their current situation, which is pretty terrible, which is 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century Eretz Israel. And they speak about it utilizing the Psukim of Eicha, which of course speak about the earlier destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And so there's something very powerful about utilizing this text about the Bavlim and talk about the Romans, or utilizing this text about Tzidkiyahu and now it's suddenly about Herod or whoever it might be in the contemporary time, or Bar Kokhba. And so the Midrash of Eicha, which is gorgeous, has goes through all five chapters, Keseder. And it has a collection that we have in several other places, including famously in Esther, but it has a collection of what's called Ptichtaot. And a Ptichta is actually called a proem, that's the word on there, a proem, which is a poetic introduction to a text. And the Ptichta is exactly what it sounds like. The Ptichta of Eicha Rabbah, there's, I think, 37 paragraphs. Some of them very short, like five lines, some of them very long, like the one we have. What we have is not even the whole Ptichta, number 24, it's part of it, in which is sort of talks in generic terms about the event of the destruction and weaves a story and always weaves psukim that are not from Eicha in and out. And ultimately, at the end of the Ptichta, you end up with the word Eicha, which we're not going to get to because we're taking a slice of this. And we're not going to see the whole thing because, as you can see, this is very big. But I wanted to show you a little bit of the flavor of what the Chachamim in Byzantine Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, the 4th century, 3rd century, what they were doing to try to connect the people with the event that they were still suffering under. I mean, it's very, very distant from us, but the event that they were very sharply aware of, and to connect it with the text, and, well, you'll see what. So in the middle of this Midrash, you have the following phrase. Amar Abraham l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is a very famous midrash in which the Avot try to defend Am Yisrael from destruction. And the notion here is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is ready to destroy Am Yisrael. That's something we've heard numerous times. We've heard it at the Egel, we've heard it with Korach, we've heard it with Meraglim. Different times HaKadosh Baruch Hu threatened to destroy the nation. In every case, Moshe stood up to defend the nation. And the argument usually was either, in the case of the Egel and the Meraglim, that this is going to be bad for your name. And in the case of Korach, it was Ha'isha Chad Yechta, only one person sinned, why are you taking out already? But it's always an appeal to God's justice. This is a whole different take. And one thing that's critical is whenever you're studying Midrash, you are not reading a text from the times of Eicha. You're reading a text from the time of the 4th century, which means you're not hearing what's going on in Eicha, you're hearing what's going on in the lives of these people and the way that they're seeing their spiritual, geopolitical, social reality, economic reality, in the light of the larger historic picture. So, Amar Avraham Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Rabbanu Shalom, Mi Me'id Ben B'Yisrael Shavur Torah Techa. Now, this is now Avraham plucked right out of Bereshit. Right, Avram and Bereshit Yochet, God says I'm going to destroy Sodom. Oh yeah, and so here Avram says, "You're going to say that Israel violated the Torah? Who's going to testify?" So in the first paragraph he says, "Let the Torah come and testify." I'm going to summarize the first few paragraphs. Let the Torah come and testify. So the Torah comes and testifies. They violated the Torah. They didn't live by me. And so Avram turns to the Torah. It's a beautiful piece. And he says, "Zichri." Look on the third line. Zichri yom shech zirecha kadosh baruch hu al kol uma v'lashon. Don't you remember the day when God gave you, offered you up to every nation? There's something very powerful about this midrash, about this take. V'lo ratzu l'kablech, and they didn't want you. Ad shebao banai lahar sinai v'kiblu otam v'chibducha. Until my children came to Har Sinai and accepted it. You're going to testify against my children. They're the only ones who would take you. Now, what's interesting about this is, who are banai in Avraham's words here? B'nai Yisrael. But who are Banai really of Abraham? B'nai Yishmael, B'nai Esav, B'nai, right? There's a whole bunch of non-Jews who are part of Banai. And the interesting thing is, this is a later Midrash floating off of an earlier Midrash, which is that before Matan Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to all the nations and said, do you want the Torah? And essentially their take was no. But that builds off of an earlier midrash. Listen very carefully, because the earlier midrash was HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to Bnei Esav and said, do you want the Torah? And they said, what does it say? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course, gives them the one line they can't live with. And that's Lo Tirtzach. He comes to Bnei Amon and Moav, you want the Torah? And of course, he gives them the one line they can't live with, which is Lo Tinaf. Well, how do you think we got here? Our mother slept with her father. Right? And then he comes to Bnei Yishmael and says, Lo Tignov, so we can't live with that. So he comes to Am Yisrael and they say, Naseh v'nishma. But notice that in the earlier form of the Midrash, the nation, are they all? Bnei Avraham. And now notice how the Midrash has turned it inside out and said, Banai, my children, came to Har Sinai and accepted it when all the everybody else rejected it. So it's a nice kind of moving circle around. All right, so the Torah goes off, Kivan Shema Torah Kach, the Torah walked to the side, couldn't testify, couldn't say anything. Now HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the 22 letters. Now, I don't know about you, but I grew up with this quote-unquote midrash as a kid. Is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to create the world, and so what letter am I going to create the world with? Right? You remember this? What letter am I going to create the world with? Great. I don't know if it's Zohar. I don't know where it's from. So you ever heard this?
Yeah.
So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, first, let me think about the Tav. Right? And the Tav comes forward and says, yeah, create me with the world, because Torah. And then on the other hand, God says, yes, but Toeva. So, okay, good. Shin, Shalom, yeah, but check it, right? Which, by the way, you could do with anything. Notice it's very important that this Midrash start with Tav, because always it's a very short Midrash. And it goes all the way through the letters, and finally gets to the Bet, and the Bet says, Bracha. So, oh, there's nothing better than Bracha, you'll be the one, right? So the Aleph Nebuch didn't get a chance. Don't worry, I'll start the Aseret Dibot with you. That's a beautiful little thing. I think this is the earlier version of it. What happens is the letters come to testify. So the Aleph comes to testify and says, and is about to testify, and Avram turns to him and says, are you kidding? Am Yisrael was at the foot of Har Sinai when Hashem said, Anochi, with an Aleph, and they accepted it. The Aleph gets embarrassed. The Bet says, what are you talking about? Bnei Yisrael accepted the Torah and testified that God created the world, Bereshit. And goes through a few of the letters. All the letters back off. They can't do anything. Then look at the next blue one. Miyad patach Avraham lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So then Avraham presents his argument. What's his argument? Because so far, Avraham has only been deflecting attacks. But he hasn't gone on the it's not really on the offensive, but on the affirmative take to defend Am Yisrael. You gave me a son in my old age. This is based on Seder Olam that Yitzchak was 37. You told me to bring him as an Ola, and I became ruthless, and I took him up, right? And so then he says, I myself tied him down. Or al bani. So you're not going to remember that and have compassion on my children? Now what's the argument here? What's the argument? What is Avraham arguing? He's trying to get God to not kill us, not destroy us. So Avraham, Bashamayim, Avraham's long dead, he's now gotten in the court. What is his argument? Why is he saying God shouldn't destroy Am Yisrael?
Because
I was ready to destroy my own son at your command, so you should not destroy them. It's a weird argument. But what's underneath this argument? So we'll see. We don't hear God's response. So we don't know if God says no, if God says yes, if God winks, if God smiles. We don't know. Patach Yitzchak v'amar. So who's standing Yitzchak? And what does Yitzchak say? You know what Yitzchak's going to say. When Father told me that the God will bring the lamb right on the way to the Akedah, I didn't protest. And I allowed myself to be tied on the Mizbeach, etc. Right, the Akedah. And so now, so you're not going to remember that for me and remember my kids for the compassion. I have compassion on them. Then Yaakov comes. And again, we don't know God's response. Yaakov comes, and he says, I was in Laban's house for 20 years, and I suffered, and then I came back, and Esav wanted to kill me and take my children, and now these are my children that I've raised, and you want to take them from me? And he says, Velotis korli zot. And that's kind of strange. Because I'm comfortable saying that what Avram and Yitzchak are arguing for is the following. We had natural, empathetic feelings of love and care and compassion, and we squelched them in favor of ruthlessness at the Akedah. You, who are naturally compassionate, should have an easier time squelching your instinct of anger and vengeance. And that's a pretty good argument. Yaakov's is a little bit difficult. And then Moshe comes along, and Moshe has a long piece to say. He starts moaning. It says something really wild here, because he says, first of all, I led them by Midbar, and then when it comes time to come to the land, you told me I couldn't go in, and that I have to accept the decree. And then he says to Yirmiyahu, Moshe comes to Yirmiyahu and says, let's go follow them, see where they are. And Yirmiyahu says back, I can't because of all the dead bodies. Remember, Yirmiyahu is a Kohen. So we now got Yirmiyahu and Moshe together. And Moshe says, nonetheless, it's Pikoch Nefesh, we've got to go save them. So they go to Bavel. And they see them in Bavel. And the Jews, listen to this, it's amazing. The Jews are sitting in Bavel and they see Moshe come and they say, Ben Amram, he's here to redeem us. And Moshe says, no, I'm just here to visit, right? And immediately a huge, shattering cry comes up from them. And that's the pasuk, Al Naharot Bavel Sham Yashavnu Gam Bachinu. That's the midrash on it. So turn the page to see where this goes. Moshe then says in the second paragraph, he says, I'm cursing the sun. Why didn't you darken yourself when the enemies came into the temple? And the sun says back, what do you want? There's a whole powerful irony in here. The sun says back, how could I stop myself? I was forced with 60 whips to shine and to not go out. I wanted to go out. I wanted to darken the place so the enemies couldn't find the place or to show that the day was cursed. But I was forced, as if Mina Shamayim, they're forcing this terrible thing to happen. Now, the reason this is so powerful is because remember Yeshua's greatest moment was Shemesh B'Givon Dom. But there's a midrash that says that Moshe himself stopped the sun. We talked about it a few years ago. that Moshe also stopped the sun, that famous story with Amalek, in the war with Amalek. And that here Moshe is saying, you obeyed me then. Why aren't you obeying me now? He says, I was forced by God to keep shining. And then Moshe turns around and says, Vayal zivach makdasha, I mourn for the beauty and glory of the Beit HaMikdash, right, that's now destroyed. And then he turns and he curses the captors, Shavai, Uy, b'chayichon, right? Don't kill all these people, don't take all these people in prison. He's like pleading for them. And then he turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the last blue thing of the upper half. Katavta v'toratecha v'shor oseh otoved b'no lo tishchatu b'yom echad. Look at that. You wrote in your Torah that we're not allowed to kill a mother and her baby on the same day. V'alo kvar hargu banim v'avoteim kama v'chama v'atashot take. And here you're watching the enemies take children and their parents and slaughter them together. And you don't do anything about it. So the arguments here against HaKadosh Baruch Hu are wide-ranging. There's arguments of saying that we have been the most loyal and there's nothing in God's religious realm that could testify against us because we could testify back that we were ultimately the most loyal. Then our offensive on it was, I demonstrated restraint over my emotions to do what you said. Now, essentially, we're pleading for you to demonstrate restraint against your emotions to do what we're saying, and none of it seems to be working. And then Moshe comes and simply pleads and mourns and eulogizes, as it were, and then his last line is, God, what you're doing is going against the commands of the Torah, which is, if you think, the most Abrahamic argument. It goes against who you said you are. You didn't allow us to slaughter a baby and its mother on the same day, and here you're allowing the enemies to do that. Okay. And we don't know what's happened. All we know, we have not heard God's voice since Avraham knocked out the letters. Avraham said who's going to testify, because Avraham said the Torah will testify. Avraham knocked that down. Hashem said the alphabet will testify. Avraham knocks that down. And then Avraham makes his own argument, Yitzhak makes his argument, Yaakov makes his argument, Moshe makes a few arguments, Moshe and the son have a dialogue in this midrash, it's beautiful, and we don't know where we are. We don't know if things are lightening up, we don't know if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's going to rethink it, we don't know. Here we go. Ve'otasha'a kafza Rachel imeinu. Now, important to note, the words that Avraham used about the fact that he was 100 and then he was asked to do an Akedah 100%. The fact that Yitzchak seemed to be aware of what was going on and allowed himself to be the Akedah, certainly. Yaakov's pain and suffering with Laban, no question about it. Moshe's leadership and then being robbed of the one thing that he wanted for to come into the land at the last minute, understood. It's all in the text. What's most fascinating is that the heroine of this story, who we all know who it is, comes here with something which is not only not in the text, but it seems to be the opposite of the text. Now, let's hear the story. So Rachel jumped in. And by the way, where is this happening? Nobody says anything. It doesn't say Yeshiva Shomala, Yeshiva Shomata. It doesn't say Pamalia Shomala. You know, we don't know. But somewhere, Esham, these voices are being heard, and Rachel jumps in. Why does she have to jump in? Why does Rachel have to jump in? Because Rachel could say, Ver binich. Who am I? Okay. V'Hakadosh Baruch Hu v'Amra, Ribono Shel Olam, Galui v'Yodu L'Fanecha, Sheyakov Avdecha Ahavani Ahava Yeterah. Yaakov, your servant, loved me with tremendous love. V'Avad B'Shvili La'Aba Sheva Shanim. He worked for my father for 7 years. U'Sheishlimu Otan Sheva Shanim V'Gi Azman Nisuai L'Ba'ali. When the 7 years were up and it was time for me to marry my husband, my father came up with this plan to switch us. Bishvil achoti, for my sister. V'ukshayal ha'adavar. I was very bothered by this. Ad meod, kino da'ali ha'itza, v'odati l'ba'ali. I told my husband this was going to happen, meaning she somehow told Yaakov. V'masarti lo siman. Now, in this verse of the Midrash, Rachel, at that point, meaning just before the wedding, gives Yaakov some sort of a secret code. Remember in some of the Midrashim, when does she give them the secret code? When they first meet. Right? Sheakir b'ni uvein achoti. So that he'll be able to recognize that it's me or not, and then he'll be able to say, oh, no, this is not the girl I want to marry. Right, so the idea is that at some point early on in their privacy time, he'll recognize it and he'll call my father on it, and it'll be the end of it. Then I had a change of heart. Listen to the way she says it. I submerged my lust. She's describing her interest in Yaakov as being very physical and very lustful, and she puts it down. And I had compassion that my sister should not be shamed. At night they put her in place of me. This image here seems to be that there's a wedding going on and Rachel's out there dancing, and then when it comes to the time of the privacy, they swipe clothes and put Leah in there. And I gave her all the secret codes. Kadeshi Savushi Rachel. And now she adds something in here, it's wild. I went under the marital bed. So Yaakov talked to Leah, thinking it was Rachel. She didn't say a word. And I was kept answering him. So he knew my voice. And she had a different voice, he would think it was her. It was me. Kadei shelo yakir l'kol achoti. V'gamalti chesed ima. I did tremendous chesed for her. V'lo kineti ba v'lo tzeiti al cherpa. I wasn't jealous of her, and I didn't allow for her to be shamed. Uma ani. Here's the kal v'chomer. Sha'ani basar v'adam. I am just a person. V'efer. Lo kineti l'tzara sheli. I did not have jealousy for my co-wife, as it were. I didn't shame her. Here, Rachel brings up for the first time what it is that's upsetting God. Up until now, it's always been, have compassion on us because I did this, I did that, the other. Have compassion because the picture is so terrible. Here, it's have compassion because why are you getting bent out of shape about Avodah Zarah? You're jealous of Avodah Zarah? And the enemies could do whatever they want to my children just because you're jealous of Avodah Zarah. Now, notice her argument. Her argument isn't, oh, Nebuch, they look so terrible, like Moshe's argument. Her argument is not, I did so much to sublimate, you sublimate also. Her argument is that I allowed my sister to take her place and I didn't exhibit jealousy. And my sister's a real person and I'm just a human. And you're God and this Avodah Zarah is nothing. Why are you being jealous and letting it get to you? It's a wild response. What happens? Miyad nitgalgalu rachamav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Suddenly God's compassion opens up. Nitgalgulu literally means rolls. Va'amar bishvilech Rachel ani machzir Yisrael b'mkoman. Notice, the original thing was I'm going to destroy the people. The argument is don't destroy the people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't say I won't destroy the people. His argument is I'm going to bring them back home. Hadahut ichtiv, and the Midrash quotes the pasuk. You have the full passage underneath. Ko amar Adonai, kol beramah nishma nihi v'chi tamurim Rachel mevakal b'neha. Rachel is weeping in Ramah, or at least we hear the voice in Ramah. It's a voice of bitterness. Rachel is weeping for her children. She won't be comforted because they're not there. Still your voice from crying, your eyes from tears. There are so many beautiful songs written in this. Idan Rachel has a gorgeous piece of this. And this is what's strange in your meow, in the pasuk. There is reward for your actions. What actions? Sitting there crying, what kind of actions? So the Midrash picks up and says, you know what actions are? It's our actions with Leah. And the reward is, they're going to come back from the enemy's territory. There's hope at the end of the road. And the children will return from their borders to their place. That, of course, became the motto of Gush Etzion when it was rebuilt in 68, so it got rebuilt, and that became the song that was a big song there. Shavanim Migvulam. But the image here is that Rachel is the one who breaks through. Now, okay, that's the Midrash. And that's, again, a piece of one Ptichta, a long Ptichta, but it's not the whole Ptichta there. That's a long piece. But what is this Midrash trying to communicate? Here we are in 4th century Eretz Yisrael. Things are pretty bad. We don't really see a light at the end of the tunnel in our regular worldly kind of environment. All we can talk is about a great old days and hope for good days to come, but we don't have anything good going on. What is the message of this Midrash? What's it trying to teach? Oh, what do you think?
There's still a possibility of return.
There is a still possibility of return. Anything else? Well, open it up. That's the nice thing about Midrash. We'll open it up.
What do you think?
I think that part one is to say that if we think back to why, see, the strange thing about her argument, so her argument comes down to jealousy for Avodah Zarah. But that's a mask, and there's something a little bit unfair about this. Why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed in the time of the Babylonians? The simple read of the text was that there was a tremendous miscarriage of justice going on in Yerushalayim, along with wholesale Avodah Zarah. Sefer Melachim lays the blame for the destruction at Menashe's feet, and Menashe is the one who had state-sponsored Avodah Zarah, etc., plus murder. Bayit Sheni, it doesn't seem to be about Avodah Zarah. Bayit Sheni seems to be about being fractious and about an unjust society and about the way people treated each other. And almost all of the explanations Chazal give for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash are about interpersonal and power things, abuse of power, and not about religious correctitude, right, and fidelity. So one of the nice things about this Midrash is it gets to kind of weave together and jump in between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni. So is it Rachel talking about Bayit Rishon and saying, why are you jealous of Avodah Zarah? But at the bottom of it, what she's demonstrating, I think, is she's saying, here, when push actually came to shove, even though I had these plans that were self-interest, it would have hurt my sister, and I acted on them. I actively went to Yaakov, and I gave him simanim, and I was ready to cut my sister off at the pass. But when push came to shove, it was her honor I was concerned about, and I put my own feelings down for her honor. And maybe the statement here is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you push us and you'll find that we're united.
Well, what's also interesting is that, talking about sisters, in terms of the second destruction, these are not really her children.
Right.
They're Leah's children.
Right.
But she's still...
Very good. Excellent point. So Rachel is actually arguing on behalf of the children that theoretically should have been hers, except for these simanim. It's a good point. So maybe that itself is what really rocks the boat here, what really moves things along. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, not only did you have compassion for your sister and for her honor, but you're putting yourself on the line in front of me on behalf of those children who, in the text, were the children whose presence really upset you. Which maybe means the same thing, is that when push actually comes to shove, you'll find that we're united. And maybe right now we're living in a time, I don't mean the 21st century, because we're not. Maybe right then, in the 4th century, we're living in a time when push is coming to shove. And things are very difficult, and you'll find that we're still united and still working together. And this may be a midrashic plea to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, through the vehicle of midrash, to actually restore us. In any case, it's a beautiful piece. And again, I said this on Shabbat, I said, tragedy is one of the greatest motivators for creativity. You know, you find way better music written in the blues than sunshiny stuff. Because, like a friend of mine once said, you know, if you're out on a date, you're not writing music, but when you're sitting by the phone waiting for it to ring, you write music. Right? So the tragedy, and Eicha is, of course, a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of Tanakh, but the Midrash Eicha is just elegant. And elegant and painful. So maybe over the course of the next few weeks we'll do a little bit more of Midrash.